Responsible investing seeks to achieve investor returns while at the same time boosting the lot of the stakeholders who are connected to the investment one is making. And there appears to be a growth in this movement as it also speaks to sustainable growth. To take us through some of the issues around responsible investing, I'm joined on the line by Andrew Cantor. He's Chief Investment Officer at Future Growth. Andrew, you say that you expect the momentum to pick up in terms of more responsible investment around climate change. What are your observations so far?
So I think there's a growing awareness in the world that global warming is real. It's no longer an academic debate. Investors have woken up to the realization that they have to start adjusting their long-term portfolios, measuring risk return, and starting to channel capital away from polluting carbon-emitting industries and towards industries that actually are going to facilitate sort of human beings living on this planet for several hundred years more.
So as South Africa, as with other nations, as we're encouraged to pursue greener technology and greener economic growth, labor unions are genuinely worried about job losses, especially in an environment where the educational outcomes have been poor. So what's your take in this regard, especially when we look at the migration from fossil fuel-based energy to renewables, for example?
So this is a challenge for South Africa. South Africa is coal rich, but doesn't have a lot of other energy producing natural resources. There's gas nearby in Mozambique, Namibia, and generally in sub-Saharan Africa. And gas is still carbon emitting, although at least it burns cleaner. But really our greatest resource is the wind and the sun. I mean, we are enormously rich in solar energy, and that is also job creating. I mean, the movement through the RIA program to create jobs through manufacturing solar panels and the like here in South Africa, plus the jobs to build and over time maintain those plants, is job creation. There, you know, inevitably economics is a force of creative destruction. You know, jobs will be lost and jobs will be gained. But net, if you're creating a more sustainable future, you should have net positive economic growth and net job creation. And particularly if your power costs are coming in lower in the long term as these alternative technologies have reached scale and are now cheaper than traditional energy resources.
Yeah. So just illustrate to us the kind of investment that's going on globally and even here in South Africa, where investors are conscious, seeking a return, but also making a material difference in the areas that they're invested in.
Okay, so the starting point there is being a responsible investor. The old days of merely seeking returns are kind of passing. Now, I want to be clear. We're in the investment business. Advantage people's pension funds and unit trust investments. We must always seek positive returns. But just as a parent must feed and clothe and educate their child, we must invest money and earn returns and be responsible to the societies and the world we live in. So globally, this is the shift that's happened. It's away from just being money-seeking, but also to seek money and also try to be a positive force. Now, I don't have quantums of money that are shifting, but the signatories, the PRI, the UN's Principles of Responsible Investing, are certainly in the trillions and trillions of dollars.
All right. So what tools can an investor who wants to invest responsibly use in order to achieve their goals? And when it comes to being pro-ESG, that is, looking at things like the environment, the social environment, and governance investment, what boxes does a company need to be ticking for one to be confident that they're ESG compliant?
Okay, so one wants to avoid ticking boxes, frankly. I mean, when we talk about environmental, social, and governance factors, these are factors of investment analysis. Normally, in the old days, if you did investment analysis, you focused on financial statements, maybe a business strategy, and a bit of managerial and assessment of the management skills. But now you're looking at additional risks. You're looking at how well the company is governed. Because we've all learned, sadly, through the SOEs and some private sector companies, that bad governance has real consequences, financial outcomes and business outcomes. Then when you look at environmental impact, well, we talk about companies that may have stranded resources, that is, resources they will never get to utilize because the world is shifting away from dirty resources. When you look at social consequences, you have to look at how companies behave in the country they live in. I mean, the micro lenders for a period of between 2008 and 2017 or 18 behaved very badly in terms of stuffing the consumer with too much debt they couldn't afford. That's a bad social outcome, how they treat their labor. These are material business risks. They affect the risk of the businesses you invest in. So So for the investor, you shouldn't have to do anything differently. Your investment manager should be assessing companies on a range of factors, financial, managerial, strategic, as well as in their environmental, social, and governance factors, to determine the appropriate risk pricing for those entities and whether we should be channeling capital to those companies and at what price.
Yeah. In your report, you raise the importance of investment analysts and fund managers needing to be constantly woke, so to speak, about a given investment, and also to speak up if there are tendencies that they're unhappy about in terms of the company that they're looking at. Do you think Steinhoff is a classic example where some members of the investment community let their guard down and almost just followed the herd?
I think it's one example, but what I'm really talking about in the article is analytical independence. And if we look at, let me make an analogy. We all understood that in the Constitution, in the formation of the new South Africa, that a free and independent press that was able to shine a light on malfeasance or inappropriate behaviors by government officials was a good thing. And we all took it for granted that a free press was a good thing. We can, like, well, it's like a, you shrugged it off. But as it turns out, a free press is actually what ended up saving South Africa from going down a very dark hole.
Mm.
Now, if you think about what analysts do and what we do as investment professionals and investment analysts, if we don't have a voice, that is the same as stifling a free press. Now, let me tell you what really happens in the world. If you come out as an analyst with a sell recommendation on a share, the company management right now has the power to embargo you from future meetings, to embargo you from future conference calls, where you can get information. They basically chastise you for not liking them. That is a direct violation of the principle of a free expression of voice.
Yeah.
Now you can say, well, maybe that's their right because they're a private company. But generally speaking, we are talking about listed entities, companies that borrow money. They borrow money or list shares on the JSE, and that's a listed capital market, which actually has strong elements of freedom of expression, freedom of speech. Some of it's false, by the way. You can see investors telling stories to try and drive a share price up or down, but then there's other analysts who come in and counterbalance that. It is a free speech environment, and there are forces at work that limit analysts from being able to freely express their speech. Could be their shareholders, their insurance companies, or banks that don't want to rattle the cage of their relationships. They want to protect their revenues. Or it could be, as I say, company management's behaving like bullies. And make no mistake, Steinhoff was a corporate bully. If you went up against Steinhoff as an analyst, they shut you down.
Mm.
That's one example, and I could name several more, but they're still listed entities, so I think I'll restrain myself.
Yes, restrain yourself. And we know that you're not shy to speak up when you've got issues. A couple of years back, you piped up about your reservations around the governance levels at key SOEs, and this was long before the revelations we've now since learned of as to the extent of the corruption that's been taking place at some of these SOEs. Do you think that
I got slated for it, right?
Yes, you did.
It was not a friendly time.
Yeah.
You know, all I did, all Future Growth did was request additional information about the governance of the SOEs. And in fact, there was a concerted effort to attack Future Growth in general and me specifically. So that was a good example of the danger of being an independent-minded analyst.
Yeah.
But
now,
in fact, an independent-minded analyst is the same as an independent-minded journalist. It's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Now you can say I told you so. But anyway, the question that I wanted to pose to you, Andrew, is do you think the institutions you raised as problematic are coming right? And with the ensuing three-way split at Eskom, do you think bond markets will have renewed appetite to buy its debt? And we know that it's already very heavily in debt.
Okay, so obviously with the transition of government, I think there's a brighter light shining, and clearly we see movements in some of the larger SOEs towards better governance and new boards of directors. By the way, I think it's important to say that not all the SOEs were bad. There's a few, and they get quite a lot of press, but there were several that we reviewed and found them had perfectly satisfactory governance in various degrees, and they were able to and willing to change their governance structures to make minor tweaks to improve them. So this is, one doesn't have to paint them all with a black brush.
No.
The ones that were problematic, and we all know who those are their new minister is making strides. They are stepping in. They're doing the right thing. Let's move on to the restructuring of Eskom. Right now, it is completely unclear to us as investors what the intention is. Just by dividing up Eskom into three parts does not necessarily make any debt go away.
Mm.
It doesn't solve a balance sheet problem of a company that is overall technically insolvent, with more liabilities than assets. It doesn't mean they can generate more electricity. So we aren't clear yet, and we're going to have to wait for the budget to determine what the government's really thinking about the resolution of Eskom's financial straits. But I think it does include probably a recapitalization. That's more equity capital. It probably relies more on the government guarantees issued against their domestic debt. And possibly it includes more project finance work, building power plants with unguaranteed money to where we fund power plants the same way as we funded wind and solar transactions with without a government guarantee.
All right, Andrew. Thank you very much for your insights and letting us know what the landscape is looking like in terms of responsible investment. That was Andrew Cantor. He's the Chief Investment Officer at Future Growth.